So I saw him, he was out there, you know, truthing, that he had the money.
He just says stuff. I don't know if you've noticed this. From time to time, Donald Trump says things that may or may not be true.
I have noticed.
The only time he really, you can depend on him to say something truthful is when there's some malevolence involved. Mm. When he's saying something that's just malevolent, he usually means it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I am not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me, which we do almost every week, but when we miss a week, like we missed last week, the legal news just explodes. It's like it knows.
And it exploded a little this morning.
It did. And now, but now that's good. We've had a big news day today, right. So I feel like it's easy to jump into.
Today,
yeah, that's right. Okay, so you were actually supposed to be in New York, right, today,
yes.
For the start of the New York election interference, right. Hush money trial, but instead you're here in the studio with me,
right.
Lucky you.
Yep.
Why is that?
Because the trial was put off a couple of weeks because Donald Trump and his lawyers filed a motion or a series of motions that basically attacked the prosecution for allegedly failing to produce relevant materials in discovery relating to the hush money allegations. And the materials were from the United States Attorney's Office. And the accusations were essentially like, well, you didn't ask for the right stuff from the U.S. Attorney's Office long ago. And it required Trump's lawyers to ask for this stuff. And then, you know, you were just basically hiding the ball. And the judge today took that apart. And when he originally scheduled this hearing, he kicked off the trial and set 2 days for this hearing. But basically, there was no hearing to be had today because he read through the papers and he just excoriated the Trump people for making unjustified allegations about the prosecution. And essentially, the bottom line is that there were some materials produced very, very late in the day by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, which had, as you may know, originally investigated the hush money allegations in connection with its prosecution of Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen did plead guilty to campaign finance violations relating to the $130,000 Stormy Daniels payment. Inexplicably, the Justice Department, when Trump was no longer president, failed to prosecute. They should have, but here we are. And essentially, they had some materials that related to the investigation. The state prosecutors asked for this stuff. And the U.S. government isn't obligated to produce it because it's the U.S. government. They got some stuff from the U.S. Attorney's Office, but apparently mostly didn't get a lot of stuff. And then late in the day, Trump's people issued a subpoena or a request to the government, and the government decided, okay, we're going to produce some stuff, the federal government. And they were trying to essentially blame D.A. Bragg and his people for that. Basically, the judge wasn't having any of it, and he really excoriated Trump's lawyers for making these, as I said, unfounded allegations. Essentially, his line was, you know, they had the right to ask, and you had the right to ask, and you didn't ask till the very, very end. And the fact that you're getting this stuff late in the day doesn't justify a postponement or of the trial because you asked so late in the day, and it's your fault. The other thing that the Trump people were hoping for was some kind of discovery sanction of maybe even dismissal against the indictment, because in New York, there are broad discovery obligations that the prosecutors have. And if you fail to abide by those, indictments can be dismissed, even indictments of guilty people. And they completely whiffed on this. There was just no basis for alleging any impropriety. And so they lost. And the trial is now scheduled for April 15, bright and early Monday morning.
So I have some questions about the timing of it. But
yep.
When you say the judge excoriated, it sounded like, just based on Mrs. Maggie Haberman's tweets,
yes.
That the lawyer, Trump's lawyer, is some guy looked very caught off guard. And that Trump was in the courtroom just like shooting daggers at him as they were getting yelled at for.
Yeah, I didn't go because I thought, oh, this is just going to be a technical discovery hearing. Boring, boring, boring. It's like, it sounds like I missed something. I should have gone down. But yeah, apparently they made a BS motion. I can never decide whether I'm allowed to use swear words on their show. But they made a BS motion and the judge called them on it. And I don't know why the Trump lawyer was so surprised about it. you're taking these risks in your hands when you're making a tendentious argument for a smart judge and accusing the other side of committing improprieties that they simply did not commit, and they were no obligation to do anything other than what they did. So I don't know why he was caught off guard. I think he might have been caught off guard by the judge's vehemence. I wasn't in the courtroom, so I can't really make an assessment of that. Trump shouldn't be shooting daggers at his lawyers. He makes his lawyers. He encourages his lawyers to make ridiculous motions. And if they get slapped down in court, well, that's the price you pay for getting your lawyers to make frivolous or meritless motions. And, you know, that's why the other set of hats, I mean, we've been talking about hats I had made, or actually the Room Raider guy made, says, make attorneys get attorneys. This is just a perfect example of how Trump gets his lawyers into trouble. I don't know whether there'll be some sanctions for this or anything like that, but, you know, getting yelled at by a judge that you're about to try a criminal case in front of isn't a good thing.
Yeah, that's right. So it like bodes poorly.
I don't know if he was yelling. I mean, in fairness, I don't know whether it was yelling, but it didn't sound good. It sounded like, from the live blogging of the hearing on Twitter that I saw, it sounded like that it was a very unpleasant moment for the defense.
Is Trump scraping the bottom of the barrel when it comes to lawyers these days? Like, is part of it that these...
Well, he's scraping it mostly an empty barrel.
Yeah.
Because, you know, most lawyers would not entertain the proposition of working for him because he's not just a criminal. I mean, you represent a guy who's guilty of something, but he's an unreasonably difficult criminal who won't follow directions and is likely to get you and, you know, other lawyers into trouble because he lies to you and he encourages you to lie to other people, which is what happened in so many instances previous to this, including in the Mar-a-Lago documents investigation. He's just trouble, and he doesn't pay his bills, and he does things that just sort of make everybody around him look bad. I mean, it's like what Rick Wilson's book, Everything Trump Touches Dies. Yeah. So, I mean, he doesn't have much to choose from. He does have a couple of talented lawyers on his various teams defending him. There's this guy Kies from Florida, who was the Solicitor General down there. There's a woman on the defense team in this case, the case that we're talking about, the hush money cover-up election fraud, Stormy Daniels case, the criminal case. Her name is Susan Nichelis, and she's apparently a very, very good lawyer by all accounts. And she's not the one who makes these, she doesn't stand out front and make these silly motions. She's sort of lays back and does some serious work, and she's going to do some serious cross-examination, and she'll probably do a very good job during this trial.
This is what Maggie's Haberman's tweet said. She said, I've seen Trump in three different court settings in the past several months, Florida Federal Court, Manhattan Federal Court, and Manhattan State Court, and this appearance by Todd Blanche, lawyer, is one of the most uncomfortable I've ever seen for a Trump lawyer.
So, that's pretty bad then, because they've had some pretty sorry moments in court, and they will continue to.
So let me ask you about the jury selection starts April 15th.
Yes.
Now, okay, so when will this trial realistically wrap up then?
I don't know. I've heard various estimates. I think it's going to, my guess is, from what I've heard, and I don't have a specific recall of what I've heard, but I'm guessing 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay, so like 2 months?
Yeah, I think this case will go to the jury.
My is that guess like from be, April 15th when
yeah,
they select
I would
a
say
jury?
From April, yeah, it's going to take them a few days to pick a jury. Apparently, it takes longer to pick a jury in New York State court than in federal court, which has been mostly my experience. So, and I think that they're going to be, I think it's probably going to be a six-week trial, just a guess.
Okay.
It will get a verdict, I think, by the end of May or beginning of June.
And if he's found guilty in this case,
yes,
then what happens?
Then he'll be sentenced.
And for something like this?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I there has been some writing on what the sentence could be. I have to familiarize myself with that.
But this is not one where, like, jail is likely on the menu.
It's
Michael Cohen went to jail, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, but he went to jail on federal campaign finance charges and a bunch of other things that he had done, mucking around with his own personal businesses and finance. I don't know exactly what he got. I don't remember what he got exactly for the campaign finance bit, but that was a federal case anyway, not a state case. I don't recall what the you always ask me these questions I'm not ready for.
I'm sorry. I wasn't even prepared for this, but
I will learn this before the sentencing. No, I mean jail is an option. Jail is on the menu of possibilities here. I don't think that these, but I think you're right, and I think the direction of your question is suggesting that these charges would not carry as heavy a sentence as some of the other charges he's facing, which is absolutely true. The Espionage Act charges in the Mar-a-Lago case, a lot of those are 10 years max.
Yeah.
You know, and they're just multiple counts. So he's got a lot of issues.
And then what does it mean? Here's another one that maybe I should have thought about beforehand. But if this is 8 weeks, that means the other trials can't go.
Yeah.
So let's say it's like June 15th. That still gives enough time for some of the other ones to move.
Yeah, I don't think there are any other cases that were likely to be tried in this window. We're going to still be waiting on the Supreme Court probably. Throughout most of this trial, we'll be waiting on the Supreme Court's decision in the immunity case on the January 6th indictment from D.C. And if the Supreme Court rules sometime in June, that case could be tried, but in September or October. I don't know. I don't think the Fani Willis case is going to get tried this year. I could be wrong. And I don't think the Mar-a-Lago documents case is going to get tried this year. It just seems that she's just very slow, and there's been some reporting recently that says that she's having trouble keeping up with the work, and we'll see.
Well, we're going to get to both those cases before the end of the show, but before we move on to our next topic, I want to say that this episode's sponsor, OneSkin, is here to help you simplify your skincare regimen. Founded by four PhDs dedicated to skin longevity, OneSkin proves you don't need a complicated routine to achieve better skin. Their topical supplements make it easy to help your skin stay younger and healthier without all the extra steps. That's great. I hate extra steps. The secret, OneSkin's proprietary OS1 peptide. It's the first ingredient scientifically proven to reduce the buildup of senescent cells, those notorious zombie cells that contribute to skin aging. Fewer zombie cells mean healthier, younger-looking skin with fewer lines and wrinkles, reduced age spots, and a stronger natural barrier, something that's especially important this time of year. Your skin does so much for you. Return the favor with OneSkin. George, it looks like you've been using OneSkin. Your skin looks great.
Well, I haven't been, but I'm looking for some way to simplify my, as I get older, I've decided I need to do a little something for my skin, but I have no idea what I'm doing.
Oh.
And so if it's one step, I'm all for it.
Well, I have the skin of a baby. So for a limited time, our listeners will get an exclusive 15% off their first OneSkin purchase using the code AskGeorge when you check out at oneskin.co. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. I've been making these appearances on CNN in the morning, and it's like super early. It's like I go from 6 to 7, but that means I gotta be up at 4:30.
And
then
you gotta go there and they gotta powder you up.
And then they gotta put all this stuff on me. So I've been using OneSkin it's a great way to have a short but effective routine in the AM because I don't have much time before going on TV. So I can't recommend it enough. And because our listeners know I love conducting focus group research, I should say that in a third party 12-week clinical study, OS1 Face was clinically proven to strengthen the skin barrier, improve skin health markers, and diminish visible signs of aging. Wrinkles were diminished in 87% of users. OneSkin is more than skincare. It's about skin longevity, targeting the root causes of aging to help you look and feel your best at every age. Get started today with 15% off using code AskGeorge at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code AskGeorge. After your purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. It's time to expect more from your skincare routine. Invest in the health of your skin with OneSkin. All right, so we're recording this on Monday, and the election interference / hush money case isn't the only big news out of New York. Just today, this is breaking. In the New York business fraud case, the Court of Appeals just agreed to accept a smaller bond of $175 million instead of the $454 million they were originally going to do. And that original bond was due today, but now Trump has an additional 10 days to obtain it. So, I don't know, to me, $175 million still sounds like a lot of money, but this does seem like a win for Trump.
Yeah, it's a small win for Trump, and I don't think it's a surprising win. In fact, put out on X or Twitter a few days ago that I thought I wouldn't be surprised if the appellate division, that's the name of this particular appeals court, the appellate division, first department, cut back on the bond requirement to some extent. And that's what they did. They cut back to, they cut it down to 175 and gave him a few extra days to see if he could come up with that money since he couldn't come up with the 464. But it's still a substantial sum of money. I'm not surprised that they did that. I read through the papers that both sides filed. They were both sides wrote very good papers, and I thought the Trump people wrote very good papers. I mean, their point was that this is in a circumstance where you have damages where somebody's suffered some out-of-pocket loss. These are damages for, you know, this is disgorgement for unjust profits. And it's not money that the state of New York needs to give to victims or anything like that. So why do they need the full bond? And that's not a crazy argument, and it could be. There are lots of different arguments here on the merits and on damages, and it could very easily be that the judgment gets cut back to some extent. I don't think it'll be thrown out altogether, but if it's cut back, it could be cut back by $100 million or $200 million and still be just a massive defeat for Donald Trump. And so if there's any possibility of that, in fairness, it makes sense that judges are exercising their equitable discretion as they have. That's what this involves. It's just the power of equity, the just trying to figure out what the sense is of what the right thing to do is. And their view is $175 million should basically cover, if they have a bond for that, that covers, you know, the state is covered. And I don't disagree with that. I mean, actually, if I were in the AG's office and it turns out that this is a bond that Trump can produce, a $175 million bond, and that means that the state's going to get $175 million no matter what, if the judgment is affirmed, they can collect on that. I'd be pretty happy with that because, frankly, if I were this state, I wouldn't be, you know, the state AG, I wouldn't be wanting to send out teams of lawyers trying to track down Donald Trump's assets. It's just a lot of effort, and it's a pain in the ass. And if Trump can produce $175 million bond, more power, that's great for the state, because the state means the state's going to get $175 if it gets at least that part of the judgment affirmed. It's kind of like it was great for E. Jean Carroll when Trump produced that bond from Chubb for that covered her $83.3 million. It means she's going to get paid. So if he can come up with a $175 and bond this, that's great for the state.
So I saw him, and I saw it on Twitter, but he was out there, you know, truthing, that he had the money. Like, he was doing a weird thing where he was like, but I have the, you know, this is, well, I don't know, it was all rigged and stolen. So, and there was a lot of people commenting on the fact that this was a bizarre thing for him to do.
He just says stuff.
Okay, so.
I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this.
I have.
From time to time, Donald Trump says things that may or may not be true.
I have noticed.
Sometimes he even contradicts himself. Sometimes he contradicts his lawyers. Sometimes he says things. The only time he really, you can depend on him to say something truthful is when there is some malevolence involved. Mm. When he's saying something that's just malevolent, he usually means it.
Yeah.
But if he's saying something on almost any other subject, you know, it could be random chance. It might be true. Mostly it isn't. So we just don't know. And the funny thing about it was, though, he was directly contradicting his lawyers. And his lawyers were trying to make the point to the court that we can't come up with this. If you can't come up with it, why are you making us try to do something we can't do? And then he goes, says, I have the money. He could have, you could have easily seen the court say, well, we saw in the newspaper that that Trump said he had the money, so motion denied. It was really self-defeating. But it's funny. It's just like the courts know not to necessarily trust the out-of-court statements of Donald Trump. And it's funny. It even happened when he was president of the United States. When he was president of the United States, the Justice Department had this continuing problem of them making representations. The lawyers in the Justice Department would make representations to the courts, and mostly the U.S. District Court here, and then Trump would put something out on Twitter that contradicted what the Justice Department was saying, and the Justice Department would, and then the other side, opposite to the Justice Department, whatever litigation was involved, would then wave, look what Trump said, the Justice Department, you can't listen to the Justice Department. And the Justice Department would say, would basically tell the court, guys, you shouldn't, court, you shouldn't trust anything this guy says on Twitter. He's the president of the United States. And there's actually a small little body of case law that says that, you know, when Donald Trump says something and the Justice Department says something, listen to the Justice Department.
You know, it's funny, except that it's also terrifying that this person was running our country.
Yes.
Hey, one thing that I was thinking about, though, on the there was like this talk of Tish James going around and starting to like seize his buildings in New York.
Yeah.
If he couldn't put up bond. And so like the conversation always turns to the political implications of that. You know, does it hurt Trump? Does it help Trump?
We're talking about what's his name's comment.
Who?
The pollster.
Oh yeah, Luntz.
Luntz. Frank. Well, Luntz
was,
Frank, my friend.
Yeah, Frank Luntz. So he was one of the people who was putting this out there. Yeah. I wasn't sure I agreed with him about this.
I don't agree with him.
Yeah, right. Like, I mean, the idea that his base would get really ticked off if they saw his buildings getting foreclosed.
There's so many things wrong with.
Well,
what
that would
Frank,
be true, but I'm not sure about the swing voters.
I don't think it's true with the swing voters, but also it's just sort of the whole premise of Luntz's commentary kind of plays into what Trump is saying, that this is all just sort of a political hit job. And Democrats, if you're smart, you wouldn't be doing this. Well, they're not doing it as a hit job. This is the legal process at work. And you can't say to the attorney general, don't enforce the laws of the state of New York and don't collect a judgment that you have validly secured in a court after a full-blown trial, because somebody might get mad at you out in the boondocks in some other state. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And it's not and I agree with you politically, you know, the people who have problems with this are going to have problems with anything that happens to Trump. As I said the other day, I said, you know, these people, you know, whether it be enforcing a judgment for rape and defamation, I mean, they're going to complain about that and say witch hunt, or making a knock knock joke about the boss. Mm-hmm. they're going to complain that he's being persecuted no matter what. It just doesn't matter to them. And so I think that I think as you point out, I think with the swing voters are going to say, whoa, a court's really
they're taking his buildings.
Done something.
Yeah, I agree with that. I do wonder though if, and you could tell me because I don't know whether they take these things into consideration or not, whether there was part of the court that lowered the bond to say, like, we don't want them going around seizing this guy's assets right now. I mean, you just said it was a pain, but I also wonder just about like optically, politically.
I think they want to be, courts want to do justice and they want to give the appearance of doing justice. Both are extremely important. And in this particular circumstance, if he's not going to be able to bond the 464, why not give him a chance to bond some significant portion of it? And at least that way, he will have had the chance. You will appear to have given him a chance. And you know, I would have done it. Frankly, that's why I tweeted the other day. I said, you know, I wouldn't be surprised I gave him a break on the bond. Why not?
Yeah. So a listener named
Carol, as I said, it's like I would be thrilled to get a bond for 175 if I were the AG.
Yeah. Because they're getting
like,
their money.
It means it's like basically I could take the 175 at the end of the day and go home. I don't have to chase him around.
Yeah. A listener named Carolyn wrote in today and asked, does the reduction in the Trump bond indicate anything about what they think about the trial court's ruling in the case in general?
It might. Okay. It could be that they suspect that there is some error in there and they'd have to cut the verdict back. Or it could be the judgment back. Or it could be just that they, you know, want to give him a chance to post some kind of a bond and appear fair to do that. We don't know. We don't know what their thinking is. They did not explain their thinking. But there are, you know, this is going to be a hard-fought appeal. And there are a lot of moving pieces to this judgment. And it could still be a big victory for the AG if she wins 6 out of 10.
Yeah. So speaking of, like, there could be twists and turns and all this, Trump's social media platform, Truth Social, merged with a publicly traded company last Friday.
Yes.
and could get a big influx of cash from doing so.
Right.
And one of the people who apparently is a big investor in the weird shell company is this guy, Jeff Yass.
Yes.
Yass?
Yass. Yes or no?
Yeah.
Yes.
And who also was the big investor in TikTok,
yep.
who and who got Trump to like flip his position on TikTok.
It's a very curious set of circumstances, but I will say this. This deal has been in the works for a very long time, and it was just pure fortuity that it, the timing of this deal happened to line up with the date of that he needed to come up with the $464 million.
That's bar. True.
Pure serendipity.
Okay.
And it's not clear whether or not he is going to be able to extract any cash out of this deal. I mean, what happened essentially is you have this pre-existing shell company that has a certain amount of capital, and you have that has been publicly trading, and then you have Trump's Truth Social, which was a private company, and you merge them, and the people who own Truth Social get some of the publicly tradable shares, except. And that's Trump. Trump's getting a whole bunch of shares for his share of share in this what's called a SPAC, special purpose acquisition vehicle, and he's getting that in exchange for this merger, and those shares, because for some reason the market is valuing them relatively highly, are worth something, except that there is what's called a lockup, I think of 90 days or 6 months. I think 6 months, where he cannot sell the shares. And the idea behind that is when you have a transaction like this, you don't want all the insiders who just got shares to dump them on the market and depress the price. The problem is, at some point, the price will drop. And the question is, how much will it drop? He can't sell them now unless he gets some kind of a waiver from the board, and I don't know that they'll agree to that. There's also restrictions on his ability to post them as collateral for a loan. What he could do, I was talking to a finance guy the other night. He said what he could do is essentially write a call option on these shares and have an agreement to sell them at a fixed price after the 6 months is over. But he'd have to take a haircut. So okay. I have a bunch of money, and these shares are trading at 40. They were trading at 30-something, I don't know. And I could say, okay, Donald, you need the money now? I'll buy an option to purchase these things at 10, 6 months from now. And I'll pay you 10 or something. I don't know. I'm just making up these numbers. So he's going to take a haircut. Mm-hmm. He'll get 10 on the back end, 10 now, instead of the full 40 that he could sell if he were able to sell the shares now, but he can't sell the shares now. So basically the bottom line is he may be able to get some cash out of it now, but somebody's going to have to basically price the risk and decide, okay, I think these shares are going to be worth at least this when the lockup period ends. So I'm willing to buy an option and pay him now to you have to do the math, and it could be that he could get some money out of it now, but he's not going to get the full value of the shares as they are priced now. He's going to have to take a big haircut.
Yeah. Well, as Mark Levin asked on Twitter.
Mark Levin.
Why? I remember you got in a little bit of a back and forth with him on this, but he was like, why can't some billionaire just bail him out? Come on, guys. What are you doing? Bail him out.
And what was my answer? My answer was something like, because he's a criminal deadbeat who doesn't pay his debts and is subject to 91 criminal accounts and is a rapist or something like that. It was like, yeah, who would lend this guy? What rational person would lend this guy money?
He got mad at you for that.
He got very mad at me about that. And it wasn't, he called me like, I don't know, he called me something very bad.
He did. I think he used asterisk. It's like Barry. He bleeped it in some way.
Yeah,
but
it was
he
like
did.
He called me like an a-hole or something like that. And I'm like, I didn't say anything bad about you. Why are you so mad, Mark?
Oh, that's right.
Mark.
This was the BetterHelp thing.
What? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We were
our
like,
sponsor,
you need some BetterHelp.
Help.
Yeah. They're not our sponsor today, but okay. Come back again. We're still talking about you. That's funny. Okay. I feel like I had another question on that, but we're going to have to go to our next ad break, which is not for BetterHelp, but for something different.
Uh-oh.
Our second sponsor today is Factor, which has made my family's eating life better and easier with delicious, ready-to-eat meals.
Hey.
Hey.
I am a Factor customer.
Get out of town.
No, I have the app on my phone. Oh, they're going to, your sponsor's going to love this. Look. And I order, there it is. Here's the Factor app. You can use it to like, if you're going away, you can decide whether you want more veggies or less veggies. You can want more protein, less protein, your soy or, you know, chicken or beef. And then if you're going away for a week or you have the meals collect up, you can go down and you're good. It's great.
Oh, well, this is terrific. I mean, every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. Maybe that's why you love it.
Look at Shay's. And now the app is asking me for feedback. What should I say? I should respond. I'm going to say,
while you look, I'm going to read this.
Extremely likely that I would recommend. In fact, I am recommending it. I put 10 extremely likely. I am recommending Factor.
You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long, just like George Conway.
If I had known, I would have brought in a couple. I would have brought a couple meals from my refrigerator.
Well, we've got them downstairs. Actually, I got to tell you, half the guys in our office live on these things.
They're crazy.
It's just true. Okay, so get started today.
I love the chicken.
And get after your goals. Factor meals take only 2 minutes to prep, so you can fuel up fast with their restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat wherever you are. You can also discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. There's no prep and no mess meals.
They also
meals.
Have these shakes that are amazing.
That's good. Yeah, people in my office also like the shakes. These dishes are ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed, which is good for me because I don't like to do any of those things. And they're flexible for your schedule. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. And they've done the math. Their meals are less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Call to action.
Look at this. I'm getting the fusilli and ground pork tomato ragu, shredded chicken taco bowl. This is like, you know, tell me we're going to do this. This is
Head
great.
To factormeals.com/AskGeorge50 and use code AskGeorge50 to get 50% off. That's code AskGeorge50 at factormeals.com.
I didn't get to do that.
That's okay. Here. Go ahead. You read this. Read this. Don't read the words. Call to action.
Head to factormeals.com/AskGeorge50 and use code AskGeorge50 to get 50% off. That's code AskGeorge50 at factormeals.com/AskGeorge50 to get 50% off.
We crushed that. That was great.
And we're back at bottom of the fourth. I could do my radio voice.
All right. Let's move on down to Florida. 2 weeks ago, Judge Cannon heard arguments about whether to grant Trump's motion to dismiss the case. This is what we missed when we were gone. Everyone was freaking out about Judge Cannon. So what is happening in this hearing? And what even happened with her thing?
I don't know. I can't figure out what she's doing. She hasn't done anything really, really terrible recently that we haven't already discussed, right? Didn't we discuss the other day when she issued the crazy order?
No, that's the thing. We never discussed that.
Okay.
You said, here, I'll just remind you. Here, let me refresh you.
What did we last
you.
Talk about her? Which crazy thing has,
like,
she done?
I think we just did an update. I don't think we had
she did this crazy thing the other day.
Yeah, hold on.
Where everybody flipped out about it.
Yeah, so last week she issued an order, and then here's what you wrote about it on Twitter. In the decades that I've been a lawyer, this is the most bizarre order I've ever seen issued by a federal judge.
Yes.
What makes that all the more amazing is that the second and third most bizarre orders I've ever seen in federal court were also issued by Judge Cannon in this case.
This is a trifecta. Absolute trifecta. I mean, the first two orders I'm talking about are the orders that she issued way back, even before the indictment was issued. Right after the search warrant, she issued one order saying that there had to be a special master, and then she issued another order saying that... restricting the government's ability to look at documents, and both of those got demolished in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit and on both of those things. And now she issued some order, a big contention that the Trump people are making here, and it's a contention that Trump has been making publicly on Truth Social, is a completely ridiculous contention that somehow the Presidential Records Act allows him to designate documents as being personal documents as opposed to property of the government. And that is complete and utter. I keep wanting to use these words, but I don't know whether I can. But it's complete BS.
You speak freely.
Okay. It's utter and complete. The Presidential Records Act basically defines what is a presidential record. And essentially, a presidential record is anything that the president gets, receives, or distributes, or anything that, you know, touches his desk in the course of his official duties, which
you would think that secrets about other countries' nuclear weapons and about our nuclear weapons and about all this defense stuff, that's government property. And there is no basis and no mechanism for him, even if he could, you know, he has this argument that he can declassify documents he cannot make these documents personal documents. They are defined by law as being the property of the United States government. And the statute says, in words of maybe one or two syllables, maybe three occasionally, it says that basically government documents that in the president's possession have to be turned over at the end of his term to the National Archives and Records Administration, which is what he did not do with a boatload of documents. And it's just a completely meritless argument. It doesn't deserve the time of day. And he made a motion to dismiss in front of Judge Cannon based upon this bullshit argument. And Judge Cannon expressed some skepticism about it. And then she issued a crazy order basically saying, I want you guys to write me jury instructions. And one of the possible jury instructions I might give would be to say, the president gets to decide under the President's Records Act that these are personal records. So essentially, I mean, you know, if that were the law, then we wouldn't have a trial. She should just dismiss the case now. But it was just utterly bizarre, and she got completely excoriated by it from everybody under the sun. I mean, I what I said was kind of mean, but I think well deserved. I've been giving her the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. I'm just been, you know, I was thinking, well, okay, she got a head over her skis a little. I think she'll want to do the right thing, and maybe she's just a little inexperienced. But this is just off the wall. I mean, this is just. There's something seriously wrong in Fort Myers.
And Pierce,
Florida, yeah, wherever she is.
I don't know where in Florida. But is she trying to help Trump with this? And that's
– well, I mean
– or is it just weird?
I think it's both. I mean, okay. I think she may want to help Trump, but I don't think she really knows how to do it. I think she's – I think the more I read and see about this judge, and there was some interesting reporting by my former associate and friend David Latt, who writes – essentially, he's a kind of a legal gossip columnist.
The most exciting kind of gossip there is.
Yes, legal gossip. You know, he likes, you know, talking about judges and clerks. And he's been doing it for a long time. But a couple of her clerks quit recently, and the question was, well, why? He's suggesting, based upon what people who know these clerks are saying, or maybe one of the clerks talked to him on background, that it's not been a good environment to work in Judge Cannon's chambers since this case came around. She's feeling a lot of pressure and a lot of heat. That's understandable. The picture you get, which is not inconsistent with the picture that I've been that's been developing in my head as I watch this, I think she's in over her head as much as anything. I think a judge who was experienced and smart and evil, who was wanting to help Trump, would have figured out a way to do it without getting into so much trouble. And I think the way that you help Trump is you just take your time deciding things. And that's the principal way to do it. But it seems like she's taking her time in the sense that because she can't keep up with it as much as anything. And it's clear that she doesn't know she has no idea what she's doing. And it's really tough because, there is a huge learning curve in becoming a judge, and there's a huge learning curve, particularly for judges in areas, in types of cases what they didn't handle in private practice or when they work for the government as a government attorney. And this is an area in her defense, this is an area, look, this is an unbelievable case to have. I mean, it involves a former president of the United States, involves classified documents, involves the Espionage Act. It's got a lot of things going on. I don't think it's that complicated a case at bottom, because the fact is he was caught red-handed with the goods. But, you know, it would be a lot of pressure, and you'd have to get up to speed on a lot of things that you might not have known before if you weren't working in the Justice Department's National Security Division for your whole life. And so In that sense, I feel for her. It would be tough for any young judge to handle this case, but a good, smart judge will get by here. And one of the problems, as I said, that this judge has is she's out there in Fort Pierce, Florida, by herself in this lone, you know, she's basically the only judge in that courthouse. If she were in Miami, she could at least consult some more experienced judges, and she can't do that. And again, that's assuming she's acting in good faith, isn't trying to help Trump in any way. But it's clear that she is. The one thing that I am absolutely dead certain on now is that she is in way over her head, and that's not good for the case. That's not good for the prosecution. It may not even be good for Trump at the end of the day, but it's not good for the country.
Yeah. Okay.
Do I talk too much?
No, that was good. Okay. I've been wondering about that one for a long time. And I guess what happens if Jack Smith needs to appeal any of this before the trial gets going? Right, that case could find itself in the same delayed posture
I think at this point, I think it's highly unlikely that case is going to go to trial before the election.
Yeah.
It just doesn't have that feel. I think she'd have to really, I mean, right now it is scheduled for sometime in the summer, but I don't think that's going to be a realistic trial date as she falls more and more behind. I think at some point it's going to be worth Jack Smith making a motion to get her off the case.
Mm-hmm.
The next time she does something that they can take up to the circuit that's whacked out, he probably should take a shot. And we'll see. But you don't want to take that shot too early. It will cause delay. But as I say, I don't think this case is going to trial before the election anyway. So he might as well at some point take a shot.
Yeah. Okay, before we wrap up, since our last episode, the judge in Georgia decided that Fani Willis can stay on the case as long as Nathan Wade stepped down, which he subsequently did. Seemed like the right decision to me. What do we know? Do we know who's taken over for Wade? Do we know what this does to the case?
No, we don't know. I mean, we don't know whether she's going to have to fill that hole or whether the other attorneys in the case can, you know, are up to the task of managing it without Wade. I don't know. I don't know the people involved.
Seems like a big loss of institutional knowledge.
You know, maybe. I mean, he clearly spent a lot of time. He's clearly a talented lawyer, although, he was criticized for not having criminal prosecution experience. He's clearly a very talented lawyer in handling complex cases, and he's done criminal defense work. It's absolutely a loss. You need a senior person who's smart and has judgment and can rally the team. And the question is whether they have anybody in house or whether she can find somebody else to slot in there to do that. I don't know. So we'll see.
What kind of harm does this do to their case?
I don't think it does any substantive harm.
Yeah.
At all.
You think she's all right?
Yeah, I think she's fine. I mean, obviously from a political standpoint, a public relations standpoint, she didn't come off all that well here.
Yeah.
But she'll, I mean, it's fine at the end of the day. I don't think it's going to affect the prosecution.
Did you think it was the right decision that the judge?
I don't know. I'm going to be agnostic on that because I don't know. I haven't read the Georgia cases. I think that it's clearly correct that there was no actual conflict of interest that would have warranted throwing the district attorney and her entire office off the case. Was there an appearance? Yeah, I guess you could say that, although, it's a bit iffy. I mean, it wasn't an appearance of anything that I thought really adversely affected the defendants. It was an appearance of, this isn't the way you run a railroad. And from a public administration standpoint, when you're running a whether it be a business or a government law office or anything, it's like you don't want to be in the circumstance where you are appointing somebody you're having a personal relationship to an important position and then paying that person and then going on vacation with it. It just doesn't look good. You could be the CEO of Exxon or something. You'd get in hot water with the board. Doesn't mean though that the business that you guys are conducting is bad or anything like that. It's just bad form. So I don't think there was an appearance of impropriety that really entitled the defendants to anything. But that said, I mean, the solution that the judge came up with, whether or not it was legally justified, was actually probably the sensible thing to do just as a practical matter. And there were a lot of people, I know my friend Norm Eisen said this, who were saying that they should have done that at the very beginning. I mean, what she should have said, yes, there's an affair, not affair, I mean, affair is probably the wrong word. Yes, there's a relationship. It didn't happen until after I hired him, but to remove any doubt, and we, you know, I paved my share for everything, so there's none of these things that defendants are saying are true. It doesn't affect them, but to give the public confidence and the defense confidence that nothing untoward is going here, Mr. Wade is going to step down and we're going to appoint somebody else. If she had done that and been, you know, a little more forthcoming with the facts instead of it's a common problem in, you know, in public life when you let something fester and you don't provide an answer and you don't provide a solution and you kind of drag it out a little bit, people get more and more suspicious. I mean, it's kind of like, I feel very bad for Kate, but the photo thing with the photo is like, you're just hurting yourself if you don't get the news out sooner, no matter how tough that may be. And that they could have cauterized themselves, I think, from all of the harm that they suffered, the political or the public relations harm that they suffered thereafter, if they had just come out and said, okay, you know, we don't think it was just required, but Nathan's going to step down.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, in crisis communications work, which is a lot of my background.
Yes. Hire her. Let's do an ad for her crisis because she's amazing.
My crisis is democracy right now, okay. but it's tell it all, tell it fast, tell the truth. That is the central tenet behind crisis communication.
Just because you say, I'm going to give you something for this, like I'm going to, you know, he's going to resign. You don't have to say, oh, we did the worst thing in the world. You just say, look, it's just, we don't want an issue here. It's more important that we prosecute this case, more important that we get back to business instead of these distractions. And Mr. Wade would say, yes, I don't want to be a distraction. This is an important case, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. And that, you know, they could have saved themselves a couple of months. I don't know how long it went on, of this immense, embarrassing, time-consuming, expensive sideshow.
And you all can save yourselves, bad times in a crisis by listening to me and George. George, as always, thanks for explaining the legal news to me, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Always fun.
Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review on your podcast app, email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com, and we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.